What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Olga Runciman. Olga is a psychiatric nurse in Denmark who has worked in long-term psychiatric care institutions. She's also a psychiatric survivor diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and today she works as a psychologist in private practice. So welcome to Madness Radio, Olga Runciman.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Will.
Okay, maybe you can just give us a little bit of a capsule summary. How did you get this? I mean, I guess that's kind of like the worst diagnosis that you can have, paranoid schizophrenic. I mean, that's like horror movies and, you know, serial killers. I mean, that's the worst sort of label that can be put on someone. How did you end up getting that diagnosis?
Well, so very briefly, I've heard voices all my life. I struggled. I've had lots of things happen to me, like so many others, of traumatic characters. I've been abused, sexually abused, all bullied. I've been sent off at the age of 8 to a boarding school, which is where the abuse occurred, and things like that. So I have that story, and I developed voices from a very early age. I managed to, survive, and they were actually helping me. I didn't understand them, but I always view them, and now today when I do understand them, I see that they kept me alive, actually, even though they became abusive themselves. I moved to Denmark, and then I became a nurse, and I became a psychiatric nurse, and was working there, and I remember some things, you know, like other people would hear voices, but they were always schizophrenics. So I used to think to myself, well, how can I be a nurse and hear voices, you know, if that's absolutely the definition of schizophrenia? And of course, I saw the lives that they, you know, were doomed to, and I used to think, oh my God. And so I, of course, was absolutely didn't mention one single word about hearing voices. But, you know, there was things, the trauma was popping up. I was beginning to get many flashbacks because I was actually in a good space, and I think perhaps I was ready, or, you know, there was sort of peace to maybe go inwards, even though I didn't feel I chose that. So I started to get many flashbacks. The voices became increasingly bad. I was also living very isolated. I'd be with people, but I didn't share anything about myself. I was very protective of myself. I was very, you know, I was a helper, and you can always hide behind a helper. Many people don't realize how little you actually share of yourself when you go into the helping role, as I did as a nurse. I found also that I didn't want help from the system. I knew I needed some help, but I didn't know where to go. And I discovered at the same time that I was working within a system that I didn't want to use. And that was actually really shocking to me, but it was absolutely crystal clear I didn't want to do that. So like many people, I dragged it out, and I got worse and worse and worse, and I ended up in the well, we call it a closed ward. I think in the UK it's section, but you know, the doors are locked, you can't get out. I remember meeting the psychiatrist who locked me up, who was looking at me and said, Olga, I'm sorry, you have schizophrenia. And I said, no, I don't. And then he said that's part of my my illness, this denial of the fact that I had this illness.
Lack of insight, yeah. It's like one of the clinical characteristics of, yeah, we're going to get into that, because that's a powerful moment of one authority trying to dominate you and you saying no, and then they kind of win at that moment.
Precisely, because all it is words. You know, the Foucauldian gaze, or whatever one wants to look at it. I mean, he had an authority to say that. And by saying, you have schizophrenia, my life changed completely. It's truly like being cursed in the olden days.
Like being cursed, that's absolutely right. It's like casting a spell on someone.
Yes.
You actually were working as a psychiatric nurse before you were hospitalized, but you had this experience of voices and you had this abuse history. And then that's so just tragic that because you saw how people were treated, you avoided treatment that just ended up making things worse because there was nowhere else to go to. And the voices, I guess the paranoid part is when you hear voices and the voices are attacking you or coming after you, or you have what are called command hallucinations or command voices. They're telling you to do things. Is that what got you the kind of the paranoid cherry on the schizophrenia cake, in a sense? Because that's sort of like, it doesn't get lower than that with the paranoid schizophrenic diagnosis.
No, I of course never believed I was paranoid. I thought it was very sensible, but I did have experiences that when I look back on it, I can see that they were perhaps a little bit extreme. I remember one time when I was so fearful, because that's, for me, paranoia has got a lot to do with fear, and I was very frightened, and I wanted some help, and I couldn't go to the psychiatrics. This was before I got admitted, and I knew I needed some help, and I went out onto the street and I stopped the buses, there's mostly buses, not that many lorries, but I was stopping them, and mainly because they were big and I needed some big help. And then this puny little man would come out, which was the driver, you know, didn't fit in with this, you know, my idea of big, and I'd say, oh, you're the wrong person, and move them on. So I did do things like that, and I also had my voices would always tell me not to trust people, which was also deemed as, you know, I'd become wary and careful about what I'd say, which of course also adds to the label. On the other hand, I think there's many good reasons to do so, and I still see that, and I still believe that. I mean, you're surrounded by a system that's insisting that you view yourself in a particular way, which didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, the system that wants to curse you and actually put you in this frame of mind that's going to be harmful for you. So you were going out into the street and stopping big trucks as part of wanting to get help. And it makes so much sense when you explain it in retrospect. Well, I just wanted help and I knew I needed big help, so I went after. But that's also, I mean, that's the kind of thing that once it gets put into a kind of a clinical soundbite, I mean, you're all done. Oh, you were running in traffic. You could have been killed. You were a danger to yourself. And you also, you know, you said something really interesting before. You know, you said that now you see your voices as protective, and that they actually came to you out of these abuse experiences, and that actually they were quite hurtful and aggressive and demanding, but ultimately they were protective. And I think that's also a really important thing for people to understand, that you're someone, I mean, I think this is also true of myself, that we're kind of at the end of a very long road. We still have a long to go, and it's a continuing journey, but we change our relationship to these experiences. So maybe in the past you were more afraid of your voices, and now you more value them. Do you still hear voices today? Is this something that you still experience today?
Yes, I still hear my voices, and I'd be actually really upset if they went away. They're definitely not as dominant or as loud or in any way, because I have a rich life now, but they're still present. They've changed character in many ways. They've actually become more talking amongst themselves.
That would be very similar to my experience. I mean, I know that there are certain situations that I get into that the voices... I have one very aggressive demonic voice that will come, and I can really understand. It makes sense that it's in these kinds of situations. And I also have some positive voices. I mean, I often tell the story of, you know, that the is it a positive voice or is it a negative voice? Is it a protective voice or is it an abuser voice? Is sometimes a little hard to understand, because I mean, when I was in San Francisco many, many years ago, and I was in a really bad state. I wouldn't leave my apartment, and I was very frightened and really struggling. And I remember I had been crying on the floor of my bathroom, and suddenly I heard this very loud voice say, "You are going to die if you don't do yoga." And that was when I, you know, I had known about yoga. I had some yoga books, but I never really, and that's when I started my yoga practice. And so, you know, was that a negative voice or a positive voice? Well, it was very threatening, but actually it had my own best interest at heart. So you got out of the hospital, and then you kind of recovered your career as a psychiatric nurse?
Well, I spent 10 years in the psychiatric system, and I became deemed as a chronic incurable schizophrenic, and I was put on the highest disability that we have here in Denmark, because they deemed me to be incapable of even earning even pocket money.
Wow, Olga, it just gets worse and worse. So you're not only diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, not only were you running in the streets in front of trucks, but you were actually considered a chronic, you know, incurable schizophrenic. You defy every stereotype about what's possible out there for people like us.
Yeah. And so I was lost in there for 10 years. The reason I came out actually was because I decided I truly couldn't live this life. I believed all the hopelessness, the stories of hopelessness, and that I must live with this. Because during those 10 years, you know, I initially started out saying I didn't have it, and I, you know, but you become, or you, I can't say, I became in a way colonized. I don't know if that's the right word.
Colonized, yeah. I think colonized makes a lot of sense, yeah.
And I ended up truly believing that I was ill and I had this incurable brain disease. I was also confused about the drugs, which is also something I talk a lot about nowadays with students, nursing students. Because, for example, I couldn't believe that the drugs I was giving people when I was working as a psychiatric nurse had such devastating impact. So when I was taking it, many of those drugs and cocktails, I never believed, or it never occurred to me, rather, that it was the medication that was also making me absolutely a vegetable, a zombie, you know.
You were taking antipsychotics. Well, which antipsychotics had you taken?
Oh, I've taken many of them during the 10 years, and on top of each other, I also took antidepressants. I took benzos. I was never given any of the bipolar ones, you know, the lithium kind, but we use antipsychotics also for people who get labeled bipolar. So I've tried a lot of them.
And so at some point you just said, I'm done. This hasn't helped me. I'm moving on.
Because I believed it all, and I believed I was truly ill, and I was so affected by the drugs and everything, I decided to commit suicide. And I planned that down to the very last detail, and then I was writing a letter to my family, because I knew that no matter what, and it was important to me to try and explain why I truly couldn't have this life. It was the most important turning point for me. I did write, I have tried everything. And there was something about that, in that fog of zombie land, that I kept returning to it. And then I realized I hadn't done what I would do. And that changed it all, because I thought, you know, of course, when I used to, in the beginning, I used to say, well, I'm a psychiatric nurse, so I know. And they would look at me and say, Olga, you're not a nurse anymore. And you won't be a nurse anymore. You know, you have to accept your illness. But anyway, I put myself as that sort of a nurse, and I thought, what would I do for, you know, this person there, Olga, that I was looking down on? And I made a plan, and that plan actually worked. And what my plan, just very briefly, was I wanted to have therapy. I'd been told all the years that I'd been in the psychiatric system that as a schizophrenic, therapy would be detrimental. In fact, I'd get it even worse. So that was not an option for me. I wanted to lose weight. I'd put on tons of weight, like so many people had, you know, sort of just that. I'd always dreamt of being I wanted to study the stars, astronomy, nothing to do with nursing or anything. And I found this course in the planetarium, which actually brought my spirituality back, that course, which was very important in my healing process. And then getting off the drugs. So I did that, and I woke up and I re-engaged with society. And it took, I still believed, and I had my suicide plan there because I truly believed I was still ill, and it took a while. But then I went to a conference where this person was speaking about recovery and said that if you looked at it through the eyes of a lived experience, he knew many that had recovered. And suddenly this idea that there was no evidence for an illness, and basically I jumped at that because I'd been every time I got an anxiety attack or something, I think, oh my God, is this illness returning, right? So when this person stood up there on the stage and talked about recovery in 2005, I think it was, we're talking quite a number of years ago now, I thought, oh my gosh. I then and there chose that direction.
I really encourage people to, you know, listen to your story more in depth on the Mad in America website. I mean, that's a powerful moment and says a lot about both suicide and about, you know, how, and I think I work in a very similar way, how we work as therapists today. Your suicide note says, I can't have this life, I've tried everything. And then you realize, wait a second, I haven't tried what I would offer myself as a nurse, as a healer, as a helper. I hadn't drawn on my own resources. And then the light bulb goes off. And what I've seen, because I struggle a lot with suicidal feelings, and that was one of the things that got me first locked up, was that it really is a strong message inside of you that says, I can't have this life. It's not, I don't want life. It's more like, I don't want this life. I want a different life, whether it's a life that doesn't have as much pain, or whether it's a life that has my dreams back alive and possible, whether I want a life of my career or my spirituality or my relationships, or just wanting a different life, and then having exhausted everything and then realizing, wait a second, there's this one thing I haven't tried. And I think that I would say that's probably one of the key things that makes my work different than a lot of the therapists out there, I think, is that I start with, what would I want? What would I want in this situation? Let me try that. What would be helpful for me? Maybe not. Maybe it's not going to be helpful for this person. Everybody's different. But at least to be able to put myself in the other person's position, I think, is a very valuable thing that doesn't come from books and clinical skills training. It actually comes from your personhood and what you've been through. And have you been through suffering? And can you relate? And can you put yourself in the other person's position? So is that something you find yourself doing a lot with the clients you work with now as a therapist?
Yes, very, very much. So I'm very open about the fact that I've been labeled. I make a lot of fun with it. Humor is always a good thing. So I absolutely try and put myself into other people's shoes. I often find when I'm working that I'm listening, but I actually have a whole listening system, which is my body, like an antenna, I kind of think. And I believe that my antenna were developed because of my life. I had to really get really attuned to the world around me because it was really dangerous at times. So I had to learn to read the signs. So I learned to read when people would say something, but there'd be something that I'd pick up. That know that the words are not to be listened to. I must listen to something else. So I've used that very much.
That really resonates with me. I grew up in a family situation that was really chaotic, and my father was always very unpredictable. My mother often as well, but I never knew whether the sweet, kind father was going to come or the scary monster was just going to, you know, scream at me. And so, yeah, it was about not just listening to the words that he said, but all the signs and the cues and the body language and that sensitivity, I think, for a long time for me was pathologized. Oh, that's part of paranoia.
Exactly.
That's part of, and I would see and feel things that other people weren't talking about. And if I tried to talk about them, they would get defensive, or they would say it's not there, or this is just in my head. But actually now, you know, I feel the same way you do, that it's actually an asset as a therapist to just really to read the signs and to notice on a very subtle level. And I think that also we underestimate the way that our bodies and our minds and our hearts attune with each other. And so when I sit down with someone, I really am like, you know, allowing myself to enter their world. And if I can be sensitive enough and open enough, the feelings that they're having, I'll have reflections of them and resonance of them inside of myself. And so if my gut is telling me something, or I'm distracted by something, or I'm feeling irritation or fear, then I start to think, well, wait a second, how does this maybe fit in to what the other person is going through? What does it show me? It's not just
exactly.
It's not just push it aside and hold on to my professional demeanor, but really allow myself to kind of enter into this mix with the other person, because you really are, it's a relationship. You're really in there with the other person. You really are.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the things that I prioritize and always state, that for me, the most important thing is establishing a relationship. And that can sometimes take a while, but the initial first meeting is usually very, very indicative of that there's a potential to build upon it. Because one thing is to have, you know, the sense of, okay, here, there, you know, I might be able to speak with her, but it still takes time, often with trust issues and stuff, to be sure. But so I really spend a lot of time with that, because I think creating also healing relationships, because many people, especially when you've been deemed psychotic or schizophrenic and stuff like that, you tend to lead a very isolated life. You know, you become excluded from society, living on the fringes. There's so many things in that. So, and to have a meaningful relationship, even though it's a therapeutic one, is very healing.
It's crucial, and that's just not offered as the kind of the standard care, is how is the pharmacology going to affect your brain? That's the question, not how can we put you into healing relationships with people. And I think that's really, really crucial. And I think that often, because of the wounding behind the mistrust and the wounding behind the kind of the suspicion or paranoia that it gets called, you know, people are really on guard against anything that's coming at them. And so, like, for example, I noticed that when I work with families and I'm meeting them in person, and the father will come in and he'll look me straight in the eye and he'll say hello and he'll shake my hand, and then the mother will step in and she'll look me straight in the eye and say hello, Mr. Hall, and shake my hand, and then maybe the son comes in and he's not saying anything. He doesn't extend his hand. He doesn't make eye contact. And in that moment, I feel like it's a little bit of a, am I on the right foot or not? Because I want to show that young person that I'm not just the smiley, handshaking Mr. Hall, but I'm also going to notice and connect with him in some way. Maybe it's my body language. Maybe it's my tone of voice that I use. Maybe just taking a bit of a moment. And then I might ask the young man, where would you like to sit? Or do you want to sit down? Or should we stay standing up? And kind of notice and connect in a way that shows that maybe I'm a little bit more trustworthy than some of the other people that he's met who just kind of roll over his experience and want to just focus on mom and dad's view of him. So there's so many of these small micro transactions that we know go into creating a good trusting relationship, and they come naturally, I think, when you have close friendships and close connections in your life. But in establishing that first step in a therapeutic, you know, so-called therapeutic connection, I think paying attention to those subtle, subtle details can be so important for some people.
I completely agree. And I really try to read that. I've often come out to families, and usually the family has contacted me because they have a son or a daughter or somebody who's in crisis, and they want me to meet with their child or adult child, and that person doesn't really want to. So I often, when I come, I say, well, you know, we won't talk about that person, but make sure that we're in the room and that the person can hear the conversation. And very often, the second or third time, they start to join to give that possibility. I've also, and I'm sure you must also experience that, but in terms of being able to disclose things that they wouldn't normally do, because psychiatrists often told them that that's a really bad symptom or stuff like that. And the fact that we've been, both of us have been in psychiatry, and I'm very clear that I don't support the way the psychiatric system works. I will have nothing to do with forced admissions or you know, drugs. In fact, I help many people off their drugs, which I know you also do. So there's an authenticity which we have been given. I'm thinking of you, including you in this one. An authenticity because we've been there. We've been in the psychiatric system and found a way out, and can see it for what it is.
It's in some ways it's such a common sense thing. I mean, people want to connect and form a close relationship with people who have similar experiences with them and who can understand where they're coming from, and it's a huge, huge thing. And I very much you know, value what you're saying about, you know, not forcing people into treatment. I mean, that's a deal that if people want, you know, if that's their choice or they want to have a crisis plan or they want, but I will make an agreement with them that no, I'm not going to be the person who, you know, calls the police or calls the hospital. And that is a huge trust building.
This whole idea of this individualization thing that where the focus of the problem is inside you. No, it is always pretty much between people and the network and what's happening in people's lives. And I think it's one of the biggest tragedies that we have a system that is so fundamentally flawed that it insists on an illness explanation and trying to align itself with a, like, broken legs or appendicitis or Parkinson's, where it doesn't have that. And that is truly harmful for many.
Olga, we don't have much time remaining. Give people your contact information and your website so they can get in touch with you.
People can get in touch with me on my website, which is called Psychovery, and it's spelled psycovery.com.
Olga Runciman, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
And thank you for inviting me. Thank you for our conversation. I enjoyed that very much.
You've been listening to an interview with Olga Runciman. Olga is a psychiatric nurse in Denmark and has worked in long-term psychiatric institutions. She's a psychiatric survivor diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and today she works as a psychologist in private practice. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall, producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
K KABU hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KABU at the Clinton. This month, on Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m., we'll celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Muertos Film and Music Night will highlight some of the Dia de los Muertos traditions of Mexico, Central and South America. We'll screen authentic Day of the Dead short films and feature live performances by Virginia Lopez, Mariachi Portland, and more. Again, that's a film celebration of Dia de los Muertos, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's 12 o'clock noon and time for the Noontime Jamboree.
You were mine for just a while. Now you're putting on the style. And you've never once looked back. Your home across the track. You're the gossip of the town, but my heart can still be found where you tossed it on the ground. Pick me up on your way down. Pick me up on your way down when you're blue and all alone. When their glamour starts to bore you, come on back where you belong. You may be their pride.